Have we taken a roll call? Everyone's here.
We're going to start that right now. And Tobias Reed here. I will call this meeting of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission to order. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on January 10th, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Laura, if you would please call the roll, we'll get started.
Yes, Treasurer Reed, I see you're here.
Yeah.
Okay. Katie Koba.
I'm here.
Representative Nathanson.
Nathanson, present.
Professor Dye.
Here.
I'm noting that our Senate position was vacated and we're yet to be notified of a replacement.
The words out of my mouth, Laura. That is exactly what I was going to say as well. And as usual, this is an experienced group, so I don't have to go through why we're here or what our process is so much. But I am excited that we have a new lineup of presenters, and very pleased, as Jacqueline is no doubt going to explain in greater detail, that we're going to hear a number of different voices today with the same high quality information that we're used to hearing. So Jacqueline, let me turn it over to you, and you can get us started. Unless, I guess I should also say Happy New Year to everyone and see if anyone wants to make any opening comments before we jump right in. I'm always eager to hear the content. So anyone have any opening comments or anything that people want to offer?
I do not.
Okay. Thank you. Jacqueline, over to you, please.
All right. Well, good afternoon and Happy New Year again to everyone here. I am Jacqueline Knight, and thank you, Treasurer Reed, always for your warm introductions and approach to these meetings. Again, I'm Jacqueline Knight, Director of Debt Management of Oregon State Treasury. Our presentation today will provide a summary of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission January 2022 report, which was distributed to each of you late last week. With me presenting today are a couple of newcomers to our team, and I will introduce all the presenting participants. We have Jaime Alvarez, who just recently joined us as Senior Debt Program Manager. He comes to us from the city of Houston, Texas, where he did similar work. We have Laura Wirth, who's been with us for quite some time, and you are all familiar with her. And we have Colin Cusar, who joined us in May of last year, and he's also a senior debt analyst, along with Laura. And Colin comes from the private sector and brings a fair amount of skills in, not a fair, a great deal of skills in finance and bond structuring. Our presentation today will cover the topics that we have highlighted here. We will focus on the state's debt, as you have seen in previous presentations, the general fund debt capacity, lottery revenue capacity, net tax supported debt as evaluated by the bond rating agencies, discuss the framework for monitoring and managing the state's debt, highlight some emerging areas of concern, and provide concluding remarks. We will commence our presentation with Jaime Alvarez, who will cover the review of the state's outstanding debt.
Jaime, unless you object, I'm going to suggest to the other members that lightly we jump in with questions when they occur, if that's all right with you.
Please.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Again, thank you. Thank you, Jacqueline. Good afternoon. My name is Jaime Alvarez. I'm the Senior Debt Program Manager for the Oregon State Treasury Office. I'm going to be giving you an overview of the outstanding debt for the state. I will start off with the four types of debt issuance categories discussed in the report. First, we have general obligation bonds. These bonds require a voter-approved constitutional amendment to be used. They pledge the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon. These bonds will include both general fund supported and non-general fund supported debt. Second category here we have is direct revenue bonds. These are generally created by statute. They are not secured by the full faith and credit of the state, but instead are supported through program revenues. Third, we have appropriation credits. These require continuing appropriation by the legislature to fund debt service payments. And lastly, we have conduit revenue bonds. These are bonds that are issued by the state without the obligation to pay debt service. The bonds are passed through and are paid by the entity on whose behalf the bonds are issued. Next slide, please. Here we will go over the four debt capacity categories. So first we have general fund supported debt. Here the state debt policy advisory commission has recommended a target debt service at or below 5% of general fund revenues. Second, we have lottery backed debt. Here we have legal bond covenants that limit the debt capacity to 4x coverage, no more than 25% of net lottery revenues. Next, we have net tax supported debt. This is a category primarily used by the rating agencies to be able to compare states to one another. And lastly, we have the non-tax supported debt. Here, there is no general debt capacity limit, but the programs in this category are managed based on the revenue streams that are available.
Oops.
Thank you. So here we have a slide representing the trends in the state's bond indebtedness. The state has approximately $11.3 billion outstanding in long-term debt as of June 30th. The chart reflects a stable trend over the last 10 years. Here we see the individual long-term debt categories and the trends associated with each. Next slide, please. Here we have the general obligation debt. The state has approximately $6.7 billion in outstanding general obligation bonds. The largest category is general fund supported debt at about $4.3 billion, which has grown over time. The remaining $2.4 billion is supported by the various dedicated funds. All these figures are as of June 30th. Next slide. So next we have the outstanding appropriation credits. The state has refunded about $1.1 billion of the higher cost appropriation debt with lower cost Article 11Q general purpose GO bonds. This brings the state's outstanding amount to about $95.7 million of certificates of participation as of June 30th. Here we have, one more. Next slide, please. So here we have the direct revenue bonds. As of June 30th, 2021, the state has approximately $4.5 billion in direct revenue bonds. This breaks out to about $2.4 billion of Oregon Department of Transportation bonds, about $1 billion of lottery revenue bonds, $937.5 million of housing program bonds, and about $57.3 million of Oregon Business Development Bond Bank Program. Here we have the conduit revenue bonds, which are securities that are issued by the state as a pass-through to finance projects for a third party. Debt service on these bonds are obligations of that third party borrower. Although the state is the issuer for these bonds, these bonds do not constitute a GO or any obligation for the state. The state has four pass-through programs as listed here. And as of June 30th, there's an estimated $3.1 billion in conduit revenue bonds outstanding. And with that, I will pass it over to Laura.
Thank you, Jaime. Any questions for Jaime before we hear from Laura? Not seeing any. Laura, please go ahead.
Thank you. As Jaime described, Oregon has general obligation bonds for long-term debt. Amendments to the Oregon Constitution allow bond indebtedness for the following GO bonds that make up our current GO outstanding debt. Most, but not all of the GO bonds are 100% general fund supported. Among those that are 100% general fund supported are state highway bonds, higher ed facility bonds, community college, and Oregon Opportunity Bonds, seismic rehabilitation for public education buildings, seismic rehabilitation for emergency service buildings, school capital public school facility bonds, and we have four general obligation bonds that are not completely general fund supported. Those are pollution control bonds, 54% of which are general fund supported, alternate energy bonds, 40%, state general purpose at 94%, and lastly, state pension obligation bonds at 36%. COPs, or certificates of participation, are additionally, they're also 100% funded. So debt management uses debt capacity modeling based on the following inputs and assumptions. It accounts for all of the $4.3 billion general fund supported debt outstanding as of June 30th. It assumes the 21-23 biennium issuance of $1.67 billion of general fund supported debt authorized by the 2021 legislature. The list here presented shows what the 2021 what it was authorized by the legislature. So this model uses OEA's December 2021 forecast over the evaluation period through fiscal year 2031. And it assumes annual debt level service of 20 years using 4.5% interest rate. Lastly, set by this commission, we target 5% of the general fund revenue to pay the general fund debt. So the December 2021 forecast shows a robust forecast of general fund revenues, exceeding the pre-pandemic projections in the December 2019 forecast and the March 21 forecast, and which was used as the basis for debt capacity recommendations for the 2021-23 biennium. General fund revenue for 2021-2023 biennium is projected to be $1.8 billion above the March forecast. We see the key drivers in general fund revenue performance to be strong personal income and corporate excise tax growth, significant federal funding under the CARES Act and ARPA, economic impact statements and recovery rebates, and lastly, localized impact of COVID-19 recession on lower income individuals. So while lower income individuals struggled, higher income filers did well in 2020 with business and investment income up despite the pandemic. So the graph shows us that beginning in 2023, revenue growth across the board will be on the uptick in personal income, corporate income tax, and also other tax. So our models show that revenues can support $1.6 billion of general fund supported authorized debt, plus it provides for an additional $7.65 billion in issuance over the forecast period. This chart shows the maximum amount of debt that can be issued at 5% in the first column. And as you can see, target capacity varies quite a bit over the evaluation period. The lowest here being 3.273, and the highest being 2.1 billion. So to even out debt issuance, we used an averaging approach. And you can see that if we added up the 2024 and the 2025 maximum debt issuance with target capacity, it would be about 1.6 billion. But using the averaging approach, that same time period gives us 1.9 billion. So using this averaging approach over the evaluation period, we come back to the target 5% debt capacity by 2031. So the December 2021 forecast supports higher issuance level in each biennium when compared to the March 2021 forecast. Because of fluctuations in revenue forecast in the past, Here we show the more recent March 2021 forecast alongside the results of the December 2021 forecast. So the future biennium issuance of $1.9 billion is markedly higher than the $1.67 billion 2021 biennium issuance authorized by the 2021 legislature. We performed a sensitivity analysis, which shows that projected debt capacity will vary with changes in interest rate assumptions or revenue projections. The results here remind us that our projections are based on forecasts that can change over time. Using our current OEA December forecast, we project $1.19 billion per biennium. However, if revenue dips by 10%, that forecast changes to $1.5 billion per biennium. If it goes up 10% of revenue, we end up at $2.1 billion per biennium. Taking a look at our interest rate sensitivity analysis, if the interest rate goes 1% higher, we project $1.7 billion per biennium, so a little bit less than our December forecast. And if it goes 1% lower, it goes up to $2 billion per biennium.
Laura, let me just confirm something there. That, if I'm remembering right, you said that was 4.5% is the base case there, so it would have to be 5.5% to reach the 1% higher, just making sure I understood that correctly.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. So, good. We're still a bit below that, I would assume, at this point, the 4.5.
Very good. But over the forecast period, so that could fluctuate, yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
You've been very conservative in that, not pushing that edge yet.
Yes.
Thank you.
So now we're going to move over to lottery revenue debt capacity, and my colleague Colin Kosar is going to take over.
Thank you, Laura.
Any questions for Laura just before we make that transition? Don't see any. Thank you, Laura. Colin, over to you, please.
Thank you. I'll be discussing the state's lottery revenue debt capacity. So, the state of Oregon utilizes lottery revenue bonds to fund many different projects and programs beneficial to Oregonians. These bonds have been used to fund light rail projects, state parks, drinking water, schools and education, and more. As of June 30th, 2021, Oregon has $1 billion of lottery revenue bonds outstanding. Next slide, please. We utilize a model to determine the debt capacity for the state's lottery revenue bonds. This model accounts for all $1 billion of lottery revenue bonds outstanding as of June 30th, 2021. Forecast lottery revenue for fiscal years 2022 to 2031 by using Oregon's Office of Economic Analysis' December 2021 revenue forecast. And the model also assumes an issuance of all $492 million of lottery revenue bonds authorized by the 2021 legislature. Bonds structured using this model assume level annual debt service, 20-year maturity, and a 4.5% interest rate. These bonds must provide a minimum of 4x maximum annual debt service coverage, meaning debt service may not exceed 25% of net lottery revenues. Next slide, please. Did the slide shift?
I think Laura is frozen, it looks like.
She moved a little bit. Uh-oh, we lost Laura now.
Okay. I can see if I can pull it up and get us.
No, I'm here. I'm just.
Turn the camera.
Not on camera. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. We should be on slide 20. Perfect. Right. Thank you. The OEA's December 2021 forecast shows a sharp increase in fiscal year 2022 lottery revenue, followed by a short-term decrease in fiscal year 23 and long-term growth through fiscal year 2031. Lottery revenue available for transfer are forecasted to grow from $1.72 billion in the 2021 to 23 biennium to $2.2 billion in the 2029 to 31 biennium. Key factors contributing to this forecast growth in lottery revenues include reopening of gaming facilities, as video lottery accounts for almost 90% of lottery revenue for the 2021 to 2023 biennium, pent-up demand and limited entertainment options, high personal income growth and demographic preference for recreational activities, competition in the gaming industry, and potential impact of generational preferences relating to gaming activities. Next slide, please. Regarding lottery revenue debt capacity, the December 2021 forecast of a strong rebound in lottery revenues provides for a debt capacity of $2.26 billion for fiscal years 2024 through 2031. This debt capacity changes from year to year, ranging from $115.4 to $632.4 million. By averaging the available debt capacity for the forecast period, the state's lottery revenue debt capacity would be $560 million in each biennium. Next slide, please.
And while we're waiting for that transition, I see Representative Nathanson has raised your hand. Do you have a question, please?
Yes, thank you. On the slide just before lottery revenue debt capacity, when we were hearing about the revenue situation, could you back up to that? Thank you very much. These are showing forecast trends. At one point, people had been talking about, well, there's only so much gaming or gambling that Oregonians were going to do, and that the type of games just meant that the pieces of the pie might be different sizes. You know, some grow and some get smaller because there's a total. But I was I noticed that the last bullet point, potential impact of generational preferences relating to gaming activities. So that's one thing. But also I started wondering, I don't think I've heard people talk about as new generations are coming into the group of people who are now able to gamble legally. Is the younger generation coming in now more likely to want to use gaming as a form of recreation or entertainment?
It's going to be a good conversation, a good discussion, I can tell. Who wants to start?
Jacqueline, could you lead the way on this one?
Well, what has been clear with the Oregon Lottery is that video gaming is a substantial portion of the lottery revenues historically. And so it looks as if people like to gather in facilities, they like to congregate, and when they have the opportunity, they run out and do it in droves. So last year we saw, when we had the executive orders that closed the facilities, lottery revenues declined to near zero in certain months. So it's very sensitive to this video gaming. We've seen the introduction of scoreboard, but it hasn't picked up as much as was anticipated. So the lion's share of the revenues on a historical basis for lottery has been the video gaming, which accounts for about between 70 and 80% generally of the lottery revenues. So the question is whether or not they'll migrate from physical facilities to more electronic platforms. And I believe in our last discussions with the lottery commission that they are actively exploring and looking at strategic alternatives to diversify the nature of the revenues.
That's what I was going to pick up on as a question. I'm guessing Dr. Dewey might have something to say on this too, in terms of the generational stuff. My suspicion would be that younger generations are probably over time going to, because they will make up a larger portion of the population, and potentially being more comfortable with that setup, that that migration, as you described it, might continue and maybe even accelerate.
Yeah, my guess is the key is, can Lottery continue to make products that appeal to that younger generation, like you said, and that's, you know, what I'm sure is somehow embedded into this forecast.
Right. Representative Nathanson, are we talking about the stuff you were thinking about?
Yes, Mr. Treasurer, and also over time, will people gamble more than they do now?
Right.
Spend more money and therefore drive the revenue up.
Well, one of the factors that were highlighted in the forecast was that people had been pent up due to this pandemic. And so the ability to get out, but also limited opportunities for free time, for how to spend your free time, made gaming, you know, a viable and sound option because travel was restricted, all kinds of other leisure activities were fairly restricted.
Yeah. At least. Yeah.
I think another thing that's going on here is it mirrors the increase in the general fund revenue. And I think both of those things are reflecting forecasts of higher income growth than originally were expected. And I'm going to guess, I don't want to put words in OEA's mouth, but I'm going to guess that they have some constant elasticity, basically some constant percentage of income they expect to be spent on gambling activity. And that's probably lifting this forecast too.
Right.
That makes sense. Yep.
Yeah, that was indeed discussed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nate, said anything else on this one? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Colin, for letting us delay you a little bit.
Oh, of course. I believe we were on slide 22 now.
Yep.
Thank you, Laura. The lottery revenue forecast has increased considerably from March 2021 to December 2021. The December 2021 forecast supports a higher issuance level in each biennium. The forecasted debt capacity per biennium increased from $515 million in the March 2021 forecast to $560 million in the December 2021 forecast, with an overall increase of $45 million. Focusing on the 2021 to 2023 biennium, the December 2021 forecast allows for an additional capacity of $23 million over the $492 million authorized by the 2021 legislature. Next slide, please. Now, two factors that could affect the forecasted lottery revenue debt capacity are change in interest rates or the lottery revenue projections. The following table is an analysis of Oregon's lottery revenue debt capacity sensitivity to changes in revenue and interest rates during the fiscal years 2023 to 2031. The base case is $2.26 billion for the period and an average of $560 million per biennium. A 10% decrease in lottery revenues decreases debt capacity by $364 million for the period. The result is a $1.9 billion debt capacity and an average of $469 million per biennium. Conversely, a 10% increase in lottery revenues increases debt capacity by $364 million. The result is a $2.63 billion debt capacity and an average of $651 million per biennium. Now, looking at interest rates, a 1% higher interest rate decreases debt capacity by $201 million, resulting in a $2.06 billion debt capacity and an average of $510 million per biennium. A 1% lower interest rate increases debt capacity by $278 million. The result is a debt capacity of $2.54 billion, averaging $629 million per biennium. Next slide, and I will now pass it over to Jacqueline.
Thank you, Colin. Any questions for Colin? See any? Back to you, Jack, please.
All right, great. I will focus on net tax supported debt, which is a metric that is used by the bond credit rating agencies to compare debt among different states. Net tax supported debt is comprised of all general fund supported debt programs, both pension bonds and 11Q bonds, which are supported by dedicated funds, certificates of participation, lottery revenues, and highway user tax revenue bonds. There are a couple of factors to focus on with, there's a lot of data here. As of June 30, 2021, Oregon's net tax-supported debt was $8.83 billion, and this is projected with our new bond bill and amortization to increase to $10.82 billion by the end of fiscal year 2023, which is the end of our biennium. And when we look at the table below, we'll see how that grows. And as of the actuals as of fiscal year 2021 is $8.83 billion. And in the middle of the page, that translates to net tax supported debt per capita of $2,069. And that is per person. And as a percent of personal income, it's 3.46%. When we go over to 2023, we see that the $10.8 billion results in net tax per person of $2,499 or 4%. Historically, the state has had strong population growth, but over the next couple of years with the COVID environment built into the forecast is limited growth in population. So we have previously been able to absorb higher levels of debt without increasing this net tax supported debt per capita. So that's to highlight that.
You may be going right here in the subsequent slide, but do you have any thoughts about how these charts look in other states right now?
It's difficult to say how the population will shift from state to state. I would think that there are some states that are losing population, and so if their debt levels remain high, they would see higher percentages. More of the industrialized states, densely populated areas, will lose population during COVID as people either establish multiple households or are working remotely. So we should see an increase in some of the maybe northeastern states. There are some states that are attracting population. Oregon is attracting population because our birth rates are low and we're not really generating from within. Our growth in Oregon is primarily from in-migration. So, so other states like Oregon or who are growing more than Oregon should see improvements in their net tax supported debt.
Thank you.
Next slide, please. This visual shows the composition of the state's net tax supported debt by the various programs that I mentioned previously that are included. That's the area in the background, the POBs being the light blue, ODOT, bonds, general purpose GEOs, COPS, et cetera. And you can see where we meet our 2069 number as of fiscal 2021. What's highlighted in green here is the median for all states, which is 1,039 in terms of net tax supported debt. In addition to the debt that I had mentioned, many of the rating agencies and investors are concerned about the funding level, pension and OPEB funding and strategies to eliminate those liabilities. This chart is a chart prepared by Standard and Poor's and basically categorize or create color schemes to identify states with different funding ratios. Oregon is one of 21 states with pension funded ratios between 60% to 80%, as highlighted in that blue area, the same color as Oregon.
that's a pretty wide range. We're absolutely towards the upper end of that range too.
Exactly. So Oregon is much closer to the upper end of that range. And we consider it to be a wide range. And we did put the rating agencies to task about this particular range in our last presentation. But right now, that is their metric that they use. I want to note that as of in October 2021, PERS reduced its assumed rate of return from 7.2% to 6.9%. Now, what does that mean? Generally, that has the impact of increasing the unfunded liability, because given that we have an unfunded liability and we have to pay benefits to individuals, we generally discount those monies, future payments to beneficiaries at the assumed rate. And if we lower the assumed rate, it's going to increase the liabilities. We did have a stellar 2021. Unfortunately, we won't see the impact of that until next year. So we'll have a short-term increase in the unfunded liability due to this reduction in the rate. And we expect next year, when we factor in the 2021 returns, to see the impact of the returns on the reduced unfunded liability.
And I'm sorry, Jacqueline, to point out that, but that is in this map. We'll see the benefit to the overall system much more quickly than that.
Hopefully, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, the money is here. It's just from a recordation perspective, what's recorded and what's shown. Yes. So the money is here. Thank you, Treasurer. Next page. And this is another representation of the state's unfunded liability when we look at other states. The orange bars represent pension unfunded liability. And the gray bars are stacked on top of it, represent OPEB unfunded liabilities. So when we look to the left, we look at states like Connecticut, New Jersey, Illinois, Hawaii, which have high combined pension and OPEB unfunded liability. And to the right, we see states like South Dakota, Wisconsin, Utah, and in the middle, towards that right end, we see Oregon with that blue arrow pointing to Oregon. And so we are the 16th lowest in terms of pension and OPEB unfunded liability per capita among all states. Furthermore, on this chart, we have those dots connected by a line, and those represent the funded ratios of each state for their pension plan. And the green line represents the median for all states in terms of pension funding status, which is 69%. Oregon, 75.8%, is well above that. And Oregon is one of 22 states that has pension funding status above the median for all states. Next slide, please. So I will turn it back over to Jaime, unless we have any questions related to that.
Go ahead, please.
What I've just reviewed.
Thank you, Jacqueline. Okay, so in this section, we'll go over the framework for monitoring and managing of the state's debt. So in this slide here, looking at the general fund debt service, you know, the state maintains a conservative, front-loaded general fund debt service profile, as you can see in the chart. So a few things to note: the dotted line here represents the debt service, the debt capacity for the forecast period at the maximum debt service. So, or the maximum debt service, which represents, you know, the 5% of general fund revenues. Additionally, all bonds represented here are fixed rate, with about 60% of the debt amortizing by the end of fiscal year 30. Also included are the existing pension obligation bonds, which are set to fully amortize by fiscal year 27, which you could see a drop off, freeing up debt capacity here. Next slide. So here we have a picture of the state's credit ratings. The state maintains a very high credit rating from S&P, Moody's, and Fitch. General fund is rated AA plus from S&P and Fitch. Lottery revenue is highly rated at AAA. ODOT also highly rated AAA. Single family is AA2. Finally, Oregon business is now at the level of general obligation. So the rating agencies have cited, you know, areas such as proactive management, sound financial controls, growing reserves, and a stable budgetary position as supporting factors for the high credit quality of the state. Next slide. Here we have some results of recent bond sales that we have completed that have been very favorable for the state, in large part due to its high credit rating. In fiscal year 21, the state issued bonds with an average life of 11 years with the all-in interest cost of approximately 2.1%. This was achieved with a combination of favorable market conditions in a historically low interest rate environment. Next slide. And I will pass it back to Jacqueline.
All right, emerging areas of concern. Here we'd just like to highlight a few issues, and they come up year after year. The Oregon School, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just saw, your hand probably went up a minute ago, Representative Nathan, but I'm sorry, it's up right now. Please.
Thank you. It was just right at the end of the slide. I noted that on the previous slide, I think you concluded with the average term is 11 years. Is that right?
That's what we've, yes. The bonds that we evaluated as new money bonds were approximately 11 years average life. The state issues 20-year debt. We took out the refunding because refunding generally have a shorter average life and don't really truly reflect the cost of new issues, new money issuances.
Yeah. So I have two, pretty wonky questions. And if you don't have the answer right now, that's fine. You can just send it to us later. First is, there's averages that can mean one thing or another. Is it the average, for example, you issue 10 bonds and you take the length of each one of the 10 and get the average, or is it the average of the money of the debt that's been issued, and what is the term, what is the average term for that?
I expect nothing less than a wonky question like this from you.
I am loving you at this moment. Because you're speaking my language. This is a duration weighted average. So it takes into consideration the amount of monies, the proceeds for each maturity and weighted across those maturities.
Okay. And the other thing is just a curiosity for me. If someone was giving this presentation 20 years ago and 10 years ago and 5 years ago, would it have been about the same average, or have we changed our practices over time for whatever reason?
I believe the average life would have remained the same. What has happened is the interest cost has likely declined for a number of reasons. One, we're in a better rate environment, but also the state has really outperformed. The state debt has really outperformed debt of similar rated state, even in the low interest rate environment. So, yes, there are two components to it, but the average life would have generally been the same.
Thank you for the answers.
Thanks for the questions.
Okay, so the school bond guarantee program is a valuable tool that provides credit enhancement to school districts and community colleges statewide, and it has the effect of lowering their interest cost on borrowing. The OSBG program pledges state aid intercept, which is activated if a local issuer is unable to pay debt service on their bonds. Statutes also permit local governments to enter into fund diversion agreements to support the issuance of POBs for an unfunded liability. Both the OSBG and the fund diversion agreements are potential claims on state aid to school and education districts. As shown in the graph, this program has grown at a rapid pace. Currently, POB debt service accounts for 7.34% of annual state school aid, and OSBG program bond debt service is 18.28%, and the combined total 25.62%. And with the dearth of bond insurance in the marketplace and potential increases in issuance, we expect to see this continue to grow. Currently, there are four small school districts that have combined annual debt service that is in excess of their state aid. I should note that to date, none of the entities have defaulted on their bonds. Next slide. In 2019, the legislature enacted SB 1049. It was codified as ORS 238-697. And this particular piece of legislation governs the issuance of POBs by local government public bodies and affects any issuances after June 11th, 2019. For any of those issuances, it requires a statistically based assessment from an independent economic or financial firm. It requires the issuer to disclose if they have a SEC registered municipal advisor. It also requires the public body to report certain information. It requires a treasurer to report certain information to the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission regarding that debt. In the actual written report, we have a list of recent issuances of debt with the available information that we have. In May 2021, the MDAC approved an OAR amendment or a couple of OAR amendments, which became effective in July. And these amendments provide guidance to municipalities on the issuance of POBs. Since the effective date of the amendments, over 29 public bodies, school districts, and community colleges have sold POBs totaling $1.3 billion. And these POBs also use this fund diversion agreements. Next slide. Another area of concern, particularly in this year, is the private activity bond volume cap allocations. I know the bell, we've been sounding the bell for years, but now I think it's come to the point where it's a grave matter for the state. There's been a significant, let me go through this slide first. The 2021 legislature allocated $442.86 million in each of calendar years 22 and 23 in the amounts listed there, much of it going to housing, roughly $152 million going to the PAB committee. Business Oregon gets a similar amount each year, $40 million, and $1 million to expanding farmer loan program. In addition, the PAB committee has the ability to the amount allocated to the PAB committee can be increased due to the population statistics that is published in by the U.S. Census Bureau in December of each year. And based on that population statistic and the IRS volume cap per capita allocations for 2022, Oregon's calendar year PAB volume cap is approximately $467 million, an increase of $24 million, which provides the PAB committee with $176 million to allocate. We ended the calendar year 2021 with $364.17 million in carry forwards that will be available to the committee at its January meeting, which is coming up in coming up next week. In terms of multifamily housing, this is one program that we have monitored extensively and actually staffed. As you can see by the graph, this program has increased significantly, and we expect to have continued increases over the next several years. Much of the conduit bonds are issued by Oregon Housing, issued through Oregon Housing and with their direction. But we do have from time to time local public housing authorities that also issue affordable housing debt. As of for fiscal year 21, there were 25 conduit bond issuances sold, totaling $433.6 million. In fiscal year 2022, Housing has estimated that that amount will increase to $756 million. The development of affordable housing project relies on the use of private activity bond volume cap because it provides them with low cost financing and also the 4% low income housing tax credit. Next slide. Well, the last 2 years has shown us the importance of ESG risk and positioning ourselves for it. Increasingly, rating agencies and bond investors are focused on assessing the ESG risk preparedness of entities like the state who sell securities. In fact, in some instances, they've indicated that they're paying up for bonds issued by such entities. Increasingly, in our official statements and documents that we produce as part of the bonding process, we will have to increase the disclosure of the state's exposure to ESG risk factors. We'll have to conduct a vulnerability assessment to climate change. What does it mean for wildfires, droughts, health pandemics? Who would have guessed 3 years ago? What does it cost the state? Other issues, aging infrastructure, social issues, affordability of governmental services. So being prepared and developing plans to enhance sustainability are of critical importance. In addition, the investors will look to us to provide progress updates, have key performance indicators, and look at, you know, benchmarking to other similar projects. To date, the state has issued 6 series of sustainability bonds that support affordable housing. In our last offering, we were asked a lot of questions about the reporting for that program, and so we expect the same for future programs. Next. conclusion. The state's general fund, as you've heard here today, has performed exceedingly well during the pandemic and is expected to surpass the pre-pandemic levels. Bonding capacity has increased over the forecast period, as well as to $7.65 billion. It supports our current biennium issuance and makes an additional $54 million available in the current biennium that was available but not authorized. Lottery revenue has demonstrated robust recovery, as we've heard. It is heavily dependent on video gaming, which we consider a risk factor and could change with the evolution of COVID-19 and its variants. Projected lottery revenues provide $2.3 billion of new lottery revenue capacity over the period, as well as provide the $23 million of recommended capacity, but unauthorized, but was not authorized by the legislature. The state maintains strong ratings. We do caution, though, the bottom point, that there needs to be, or we recommend, evaluation and management of key revenue and budgetary risk factors, as well as reviewing the reserves, how we fund reserves, and whether or not we need to improve those reserves, as they are a very important component of ongoing debt management. They provide liquidity and stability in the budgeting process. And as we saw earlier on in the COVID-19 environment, the Education Stability Fund had to be drawn on initially. It was then replenished, but it did provide, it did meet its goal of providing liquidity. So these are assessing risk, budgetary risk, based on factors. We recommend that there is more effort placed on that so that we can adequately prepare and make the state more sustainable in this situation where there are adverse conditions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jacqueline. Thank you, Jaime. Thank you, Colin. As always, very comprehensive and thorough presentation. The only downside of how thorough you were is that I feel like we may have shortchanged our commissioners a little bit in terms of the comments and feedback that you all might have. I appreciated the fact that we did get into some discussion in the midst, but I'm cognizant of the clock here, so I want to open it up generally. If there are comments, also in general, keep in mind that you have in your inbox the narrative form of this presentation, and as always, we'll want to hear your feedback and any edits that you think might be necessary. We can go over that process in a little more detail. But for the moment, any feedback, questions, or other reactions that we should take into account, please? Everybody seems okay, I guess. Big sighs. There's plenty of room for that, too. Jacqueline, do you want to then sort of describe how you would like to see us proceed in terms of the draft and feedback before we transmit to the legislature?
Yes. We have provided you with a PDF, and we can provide you with a Word document if you prefer, and you can direct all changes to Laura Worth, who will field it within our team, and we will address those changes, and if need be, we will recirculate it to the commissioners, and Treasurer Reed, you can instruct us on how we would get the final approval. Perhaps we can do an email vote once we have it finalized.
Let's keep in touch on what we will need to do. Of course, the answer to that will depend on if there are significant changes or if it's a matter of punctuation or something minor. we may not need to reconvene. But I think what we've heard today and the general nods of consensus I've been seeing on the screen suggest that changes are likely to be relatively minor, unless we discover something we can't anticipate right now. I don't want to do the classic cold call I remember from business school, but I'm looking. You can't tell, but I'm looking around the screen on my screen to see if anybody does have anything they want to say. Any commissioners who haven't spoken yet? I'm not seeing anything. So, Jacqueline, if that's it, we might actually end up adjourning pretty close to on time. Representative Nathanson says she's going to watch your email for updates. We'll certainly get it to you. Appreciate that. Anything else that we need to cover, Jacqueline?
I did want to note that Representative Nathanson, before we convene the meeting, asked about the use of ARPA funds, and mm-hmm. be happy to share that, at least what we present to the rating agency presentations to the group separately.
Great. Thank you. And I see, Laura, you have your hand raised too.
Yes, my question would be timing. Do we want to set a time for review?
I think that's a great idea. Deadlines are always useful in these situations. We have it in hand, so that's not a delay. I hesitate to be the one to say something specifically, but would the end of the week be a reasonable time for everyone? I'm seeing nods. That work for you, Jacqueline, and your team, looks
yes.
like?
Yes, okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Laura, that works for you too?
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, so we'll look forward to hearing from you by the end of the week. And with that, anything else we need to cover, Jacqueline?
No, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks everyone. Happy New Year. We appreciate the time as always, and we'll see you soon. We're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and have a good one.
You too.
Take care.